Hello, what have we here?
Hey everyone, welcome back to Resistance Radio. It's episode 43. Hope you all enjoyed last week's show, because this week it's all about Galen Erso. As always, I'm Mikey B, joined by my co-host Danya.
What's up, guys?
What's up, Doc? If you want to get involved in the conversation, you can get a hold of us on Twitter at @rradiopodcast, leave a comment on our Facebook, or send us an email through our website, resistanceradio.net. You can also leave a comment on this post when it goes up on hyperbole.com. Also, today's podcast is brought to you by audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/resistanceradio. With over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, get the latest Star Wars audiobook for free. We also have merch on our website, t-shirts and buttons. Check them out. Great gift for yourself or for a friend with all that wonderful holiday money, if you got any, to wear the Poe Dameron t-shirt. Like, come on, it's a Poe Dameron X-Wing. How can you not love it? Anyway, on to the news. We had some interesting news this week. Not a whole lot. You know, right now we're in the lull after a Star Wars film and we're waiting for the new stuff to come out, but we had some interesting news. Last week we talked about the possibility of Woody Harrelson joining the Star Wars Han Solo film.
I love saying that so know, much, right? Guys. Han Solo, Solo I'm film. Not going to be over it anytime soon. Han Solo, Solo movie.
So if he doesn't have Chewbacca, will he be going solo? So many jokes. Anyway, it has been confirmed that Woody Harrelson has signed on. I just hope he says, all right, all right, all right, you know? Sorry, I love Woody Harrelson. So we were kind of talking about, like, is it something we were like, were we hoping for or not hoping for? I still don't see Han Solo having a mentor, if you will, but maybe someone he works with. I don't know. We'll see how this works out. But what do you think about this? Are you happy? You know, we kind of talked about it a little bit last week.
I mean, again, I'm kind of just a little bit about it. Like, I said on last week's show, I go through, like, peaks and troughs with the Han Solo movie. Because at certain points, they'll, like, release a little bit of news where I'm like, oh, actually, that could move it in an interesting direction, and I'd like to see where it goes. And then they kind of ruin it by releasing other news. Honestly, I'm not too sure about the film just in general, so I'm kind of holding out for more information, because for now I'm just, this is probably the Star Wars film I've been least interested in seeing, which Danya, is really weird for me.
Danya, I'm getting important news right now. It looks like Woody Harrelson has signed on to be a young Chewbacca, is what I've been told.
What?
I'm joking. I wanted to see if you would have any reaction to it. I'll cut that out. You'll have him be, you know, all right, all right, all right. You know, who knows? It was bad.
Really, Mikey.
Okay, let's move on. Hey, I'm having a good day today. All right, Woody Harrelson is in Star Wars, and we'll see what
he's
goes on.
He's not Chewbacca. If you guys didn't get that, just don't trust Mikey.
Maybe he is. Maybe he isn't. Who knows? You don't know. We really don't know who he's going to be. Maybe he will be. Anyway, moving on. Carrie Fisher had key scenes in episode 8 and 9. Obviously, they completed filming last summer, or the summer of episode 8. But Lucasfilm is getting together next week to discuss what will happen in episode 9 and what type of plot changes or what they will do with Carrie Fisher, obviously having passed away over the holiday time. What do you think about what they're going to do? You know, obviously, they have, you know, we've talked about this, like, you know, what are they going to be doing? Someone has to be thinking about this, right? And obviously, they have Colin Trevorrow coming in next week to discuss with Kathleen Kennedy about this. You know, one of the options that they talked about in The Hollywood Reporter is using CGI, which we kind of talked about in Rogue One. Is it too soon to do that, you think?
I mean, for me, it'd feel too soon, and I also feel like it would be difficult for the actors on set to interact with, you know, it's obviously going to be someone with, like, all of the motion capture stuff mm-hmm. on them as well, for, like, the face, for getting all of that right for being able to animate, but I feel like it would be really an odd experience for them, especially for such a close-knit cast, that having to reconcile with that when it's so soon, because yes, okay, it won't be coming out, and when does it come out? Not 2019, right? 2019?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So that's at least some distance from her passing away, but they'll be working on the film pretty much continuously, even with the Star Wars stories being done, the standalone films. So I feel like it would be very, very odd for them. Not only then would the audience have to, like, get their head around it, because it would still be very, very soon after the fact, but it's something that Carrie Fisher's estate would have to be thinking about now. Yeah. And that's really not something I think that they're going to be wanting to think about, especially because it's pretty much going to be Billy yeah. and it's
brother Todd,
isn't
right?
Yeah, Todd. Who are mourning not just Carrie, but Debbie as well. Mm-hmm. So it's such a difficult situation, because they're grieving. It's still so soon after the fact, but because of the nature of the industry that they're in and the role that she had in Star Wars and how production works, it's something that they're going to need to think about sooner than anyone would probably be comfortable with, which means that it's going to be difficult for them to make a decision, because that all of that emotion is still so raw. And I can't imagine that there's any right answer for what is going to be the best thing to do.
I have a question for you. You think about this. We know Disney received a payout when Carrie Fisher passed away, because they had an insurance policy on her, right? You know, that's not a way to think, like, oh, you know, I've seen people say, oh, there's the conspiracy theories, but, you know, that happens all the time. You take out, you know, big studios take out insurance policies on lead actors and actresses all the time. So the question is, because she had a contract to do episode 9 also, do they even have to ask, you know, her estate whether she can be in that film, or do they literally own the right to her likeness to be able to, because they had that contract?
Well, the contract is going to be for her specifically, not her likeness, unless it's written into the contract that her likeness is also.
So, okay, so her likeness is not going to be something that is really tied to it. And that is just something I'm thinking about as you're talking about, you know, they have.
Yeah,
you know,
no, going but to also, it. Also you think about it, would they do that? Even if they did have the rights to use her likeness, you know, I understand that it's a business, but they're so close and they have so much respect for Carrie that I feel like they wouldn't go against the wishes of her daughter or her brother.
No.
So, I don't know. And I honestly don't know what the right answer is either. For me, I feel like it would be too soon after the fact of her death to see her almost reanimated in CG form.
Now they did that with someone from Fast and the Furious, Paul Walker, didn't they?
Yeah,
but his brother played him, and they CGI'd on his face.
Yeah, but it was only like a very, very brief. Like, it was a very brief.
Yeah, it was
moment.
At the very end, from what I remember.
Now, obviously, he had been a huge part of that franchise in the films, and was a major character, and they wrote around that, though, in probably what I think is one of the most respectful ways that I think that they've done it. I'm a huge fan of the Fast and the Furious franchise,
they're
by the
fun
way.
Films, they are. I agree.
For anyone really listening, like, not even guilty pleasure. I feel zero guilt about it at all. I love those films a lot. Like,
you've seen the
I go
for the most recent one?
Like. Oh my god, yes. So, but the nature of how those films work, the Fast and the Furious, in that, you know, it was probably easier to write around that and have a very small but very touching tribute at the end that works within their narrative is not going to be something that's going to work for Star Wars, because Leia is basically leading the resistance. She is the figurehead of this resistance. She is holding everyone together. She is obviously a key part of connecting to Luke, and then also Ben, and all of those characters. So she's far more central, and it's not something that they're going to be able to write around very easily. It's going to take a lot of them sitting down and hashing this out and deciding what they're going to have to do. Now, is it possible they could find someone with a likeness to her and recast it? Again, very, very difficult to say what they're going to do. I just hope that whatever they do just goes along with the wishes of Billy and Todd, because that is one of the most important things. And I feel like they will, and I feel like they'll do what's best and in the interests of everyone, because, yeah, you think about it, everyone on that set is going to be grieving.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the biggest thing, the hardest thing for this, and I don't feel, you know, any jealousy of the people who have to work on this issue, so I'm, you know, best of luck to them. Also have to figure out how to make the story work, and obviously to, you know, Carrie's family. But supposedly from Hollywood Reporter, there is a Leia and Luke reunion, obviously in episode 8, and they both confront Kylo Ren, but Leia was supposed to have even a bigger part in episode 9 than she was in episode 8. So with someone being such a central character, a bigger part, even more than what she had in, you know, Force Awakens, you have to think that, you know, just completely writing her out may not be the easiest thing. So it definitely has to be something that they have to kind of do delicate. And, you know, as much as I feel myself personally, I feel like it'd be almost too soon to see a CGI Carrie. It might be a very impactful way to see her character, you know, if her character got a death scene or something like that, a nice tribute on screen with it. And the downside would be is, like, you, I think you mentioned last week, is if they do an on-screen funeral for General Leia, it has to be General Leia and not Carrie. Otherwise, it's going to hit too close to home for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it will anyway, regardless. But
that's true.
It's just, it's a difficult place to be emotionally for everyone involved in this decision. So it, there's not going to be an easy answer at all. And no matter what they do, I feel like some subsets of fans will feel differently about it. But I trust that they'll do right by Carrie. I really, really do. But I'm not sure, considering how big a part she was supposed to have in episode 9, my worry with them using a CGI version of Leia is that, for me particularly, and for people who pick up on it quite a lot, like, don't get me wrong, what they managed to achieve in Rogue One was incredible. It's probably the closest to a real human likeness that we've ever got from CGI effects with Tarkin particularly. But I could still tell immediately.
Yeah. No, you can tell he was... there's something off. It's the uncanny valley, you know, syndrome.
Yeah,
it's
that's
like
what...
so close.
Yeah, so there is an issue with the uncanny valley that it could throw people out of the movie, because every time she would come on screen, it would very obviously be to people that it is not her. Mm-hmm. And you run the risk then of losing that immersion in the world and treading that line between tribute or trying to figure it out to make the film work, and then potentially alienating parts of the audience from, like, emotionally connecting because it doesn't look quite right. So there's a lot of things to take into account with that, because there's so many studies done on the Uncanny Valley and how it can, like,
backfire.
How it can weird people out, and it can break a film. And I don't think that would be something that Carrie would want either.
No, not at all. It's not with her character.
I don't know. It's just, there's no easy answer to it.
So, like,
and I hate the thought that we have to think about it.
I know. And I like I said, I'm not jealous of the people who have to come up with this. So best of luck to you guys, because it's going to be a tough question to answer. We also got some news about episode 8. Rian Johnson talked to USA Today. And says Luke is going to have a very large part in the film. He also reconfirmed, just like we saw with the teaser of episode 8 filming, that it picks up exactly where episode 7 finished, on Act 2 with Rey and Luke staring at each other, longingly into each other's eyes, which is a first time for a Star Wars film. There's always been some type of time space between the different films. And I think the shortest time space was probably between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, where there's just a year. Passing between the two, or just short of a year. So it's interesting that this is taken up right after another, and I almost wonder what episode 9 will bring. Is it going to be a continuation happening right afterwards, or is there going to be some time lapse, like we saw in the original trilogy, or even prequels? So what do you think about this? Getting lots of Luke central to the story of
episode... Good?
I know, right? It's good?
I love Luke! Like, sorry, right. It's like, it's yes? Thank God?
I know, right?
We
waited an entire movie for Luke, and now we get Luke. I'm excited. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't begrudge them the decision that they made with The Force Awakens, and I feel like it was the right one for that film, because trying to introduce all of these new characters, if you'd have put Luke on screen with them, then I doubt that people would have been able to connect with them as quickly and as readily as they did, because Luke would have been the central focus alongside Han and Leia, because that is what is familiar. So I understand why they did what they did in The Force Awakens, and I think narratively it was incredibly successful, because it wasn't as though he wasn't in the film. His presence was very keenly felt in the whole plot, essentially being about figuring out where he was. But I am glad that we're going to be able to get to see Luke. I think it'll be interesting to see what place he's in his life, how familiar or how much he's changed since we last saw him. And I don't know, I'm really excited for it, especially because I absolutely adore Mark Hamill as well. So it's just going to be nice. It's going to be so great to see. And also it's going to be great to see what kind of a teacher he is.
Yeah, with Rey.
When he's training Rey.
Yeah, supposedly the relationship between Luke and Rey is going to be a very critical plot point. It's going to be pretty significant in that, because obviously Rey is our main character of the new trio, at least, if you'd say, in the last film. So her coming to realization of what she has, the power, the gift, the Force, and obviously her relationship with her parentage, which we don't know about, which maybe we'll find out eventually. But yeah, so it should be good. I'm glad that Rian Johnson talked to us about that and kind of confirmed it. And like I said, it's going to be awesome just to be able to pick up, so I bet you there's going to be many theaters playing, see episode 7 right before episode 8, type films that you can see. So I'm excited to see episode 8 when it comes out for Luke alone.
Yeah, me too.
Who doesn't love Jedi? Who doesn't love Jedi, right?
Yeah. I mean, I love the Jedi. I do. Well, I'm mostly partial to
it's lightsabers. Lightsabers. That's what
everyone wants. But I will say that I am definitely an X-Wing pilot girl. That's where my weakness tends to lie. Yeah.
All right. A side note here. Do you ever read the Star Wars subreddit?
Which one?
Our Star Just Wars.
Our Star Wars? Yeah, I do.
So this week on Our Star Wars was a picture of someone who created a Rebel Pilot cosplay right after A New Hope came out. And basically, of course, it got even better. Best of Reddit was that the daughter of the person who was in that picture from 1978, I think the picture was from, or maybe 1980, they basically, the daughter of it pulled, showed up in the comments and said, here's proof, and here's his mom, and then basically talked about how her mom went ahead and made that costume, how she would go to the movie theater with a pen and notebook and take notes about the costume. And this is like one of the early cosplays, you know, in the early 1979 of Rebel Pilot. Did you see that picture at all?
I did not.
It was pretty awesome. I'll have to find it. We'll link it and we'll just tweet it out to everybody to see it. But
That's amazing. I love it. It was really cool.
Helmet, not quite, you know, I don't know if it would be Rebel Legion standard today's date. You know, we now have, you know, DVD players and Blu-rays to screen cap and see accuracy. But I think in the 70s and 80s where they weren't actually releasing these films on home video and having to go to the theater that many times to see it, I think she did a pretty good job. But that's, you know, that's my opinion. All right. Moving on to the last bit of news we're going to talk about is the mid-season premiere of Star Wars Rebels, The Ghosts of Geonosis, Part 1 and 2. So what did you think of it? Like, oh, we can't look at this as Part 1 and Part 2. We just have to look at it as one, because it is one story. What did you think of this, Danya?
I thought it was an interesting story. It was, especially after seeing Saul Guerrera so recently in Rogue One, I think it was an interesting choice to have him in the mid-season premiere and almost reintroduce him at this kind of midway point between the Saul Guerrera that we had known from Clone Wars versus the Saul Guerrera that we saw in Rogue One. So I feel like it was an interesting choice to reintroduce him here. Very, very cool, though, that he was being voiced by Forrest Whitaker. So I was super into that, because you could tell the progression of voice from when we knew him in Clone Wars, and then his breathlessness in Rogue One, then this sort of midway point. So it was really, really interesting to me, and also reaffirmed like how willing he is to go to extreme levels in order to protect people, or at least that's what he says. Like, he excuses a lot of it as them being at war, and that's why he can sort of get away with some of the atrocities that he's, you know, that he's committing. So it was really interesting as a character study, I think. I feel like not a lot actually happened for an episode that was a two-parter. It felt very, I don't know, it felt very quiet to me. Like, there wasn't a lot going on around them. It was very, very, almost like a meandering pace. Especially after seeing like the trailer for the back half of this season, and how like frenetic it was, and how crazy everything was getting, and like all of that. This felt very low key, almost. Not saying that I didn't enjoy it, but it was a much different speed than what the trailers, the mid-season trailers suggested that this back half of the season would be like. I enjoyed it, though.
Yeah, I think the difference in this one is I think they knew they had two episodes to really tell the story, so it did have a different pace than what we might be used to, just because typically Rebels is about 22 minutes due to commercials and stuff like that. So with them having double the time to tell the single story, I think they kind of stretched it out a little bit. You know, there was a few things that I didn't think needed to, like, you know, were just kind of there, but not really that important. Like, a good example, Sabine and Zeb stealing the core, and them being surrounded by droids. Like, okay, that's kind of cool, but, you know, they spent a lot of time, you know, going through it, which it made some suspense, but it wasn't something that was so critical, you know, tied to the plot of the story that they were trying to tell. And I think they had the freedom to be able to do something like that. And there were some really good parts to it, too, showing that even though, you know, we've moved past the Clone Wars. You know, these, you know, droid Deka's, you know, the destroyers are still, you know, killing machines, and you know, our crew recognized it, so there's still something to be scared of. So you know, it was definitely something I feel like I like the episode overall, but I will say, I think Saw Gerrera is an asshole. I'm just gonna say it flat out. Like, while watching it, my wife and I were watching it, and she's like, "I don't like him." I'm like, "Yeah, I remember him in Clone Wars. He was kind of nice. He was still kind of a jerk, but he had all this hope. I feel like hope is, you know, like you see it in Rogue One. Like, he wants to have hope, but he's kind of old and bitter. And you can see it in Rogue One and Rebels quite a bit. Like, he was kind of a jerk through the whole thing until the very end, and even then, it's like."
I mean, there's jerk, and then there's...
All right,
I mean,
an asshole the whole time. And then he was, you know, he was there. He was, I don't know, like, I just... He rubbed me the wrong way the entire time. Like, the entire time he was on screen. And, you know, and I get it, like, you know, we knew Saw Gerrera was definitely an extremist. We see this in, you know, Bloodline. We see this in Rogue One. We, you know, they talk about him. You know, we see it's mentioned in lots of different places. We know he was a guerrilla fighter, you know, from Clone War, you know, from Clone Wars and stuff. So, like, we get his character type, but it, you know, he's supposed to be one of the good guys. He's just a little extreme. But man, like, he was hard to even want to like. And it's interesting because
I didn't like him in this episode, and I don't think we were supposed to. I think what this did, and did very successfully, is showed that no matter what side you fall on in, like, your ideals and your political ideologies, there are always going to be extremists on either side who are going to weaponize their beliefs in order to attack people that they see as against them. And yes, you may align with one side or the other and believe that they're right, but again, you have to remember, on either side, those people believe that they're right. However, you have to also understand that sometimes your actions, you are actually no better than the people that you're fighting against. Like, I don't know if anyone else read it this way, but his insistence on calling the Genosians bugs, like, it felt very much like a slur to me.
I didn't take that until I read it in Mikhail's article, and until you bring it up, but you know, I kind of saw it because you also saw Rex referred to as a bug too, and you got to remember, I don't think Rex meant it in a slur at all. You know, he was a clone. You know, he's been slurred too if you think of it that way. And just because someone's discriminated against you, you can't discriminate someone else and say it's okay. But you know, they call, you know, the droids clankers, right? And they called the Genosians bugs. You know, these were enemies of his that he fought, and it was short term. There's all sorts of things, you know, like that they give short names to. And this is not just like people. This is like cars and different types of things that they do. So
yeah, but I would argue that the Genosians, whether they can communicate with them in their language or not, are a sentient species who are very intelligent.
And, I agree.
And so reducing them to almost being an object in order to make it easier to hate them. Like, for me,
I'm talking about like being able to call, like, in the time of war, being able to call out where, you know, an enemy is attacking from or something like that. Again, you see this in the Clone Wars, you know, Attack of the Clones. You also see this in the Clone Wars series. They use shortening of different terms, like, again, clankers right away instead of, you know, battle droid. Even though in episode one, they were clearly referred to only as battle droids. But now they're in the heart of war, being able to call out stuff like that. But I will say, Saw's use of the term bug, even after, because he still referred to it as a bug, even after started to refer to it. Because, like, I will say, what do you call it? Rex referred to the Genosian as Click-Clack after Ezra kind of humanized it, gave it a name, if you will.
Yeah.
But Saw Gerrera still referred to it as a bug. And I feel like that
sat really oddly for me as well, though, because it required someone to humanize the Genosian before they realized that it was its own autonomous being.
Well, like, I don't know if it... Well, here, I'm going to say this. I don't think it actually humanized him. I think he even asked him what's his name, but they didn't understand him. So there's a communication error. And, you know, and so he gave him a name based on what he had, you know, he clicked and clacked to say his name. And I think he just kind of mimicked it by calling him Click Clack, because that's what, you know, it's making those sounds. So I don't know if it's humanizing, but I think attempting to, like, put it this way, I am horrible with names. I mean, I'm absolutely horrible. I will attempt to say your name as best I can, even if I'm saying it wrong. And I really am trying. I'm not meaning anything negative of it, but I'm trying. And so if I end up using something that's similar to it, well, and I think that's what Ezra was doing. And I think everyone else who started to call the Indian Ocean Click Clack agreed. Like I don't think there was any, I don't think it was a humanization thing through it. I think it was purely like, that's the best they can do without going further. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, I feel so like that was up until they actually had a Genosian in front of them and realizing that, hold on, this is someone who is quite intelligent in their own being and someone who can think and also has feelings and like all of that. But it was juxtaposed against Saw very clearly refusing to budge from calling it a bug. And that was where I was like getting the feeling that it was dehumanizing. And not saying that the Genosian should be like, I'm using humanized and dehumanized in like meaning that it's not an autonomous being. So it was removing any emotion from the situation at all and not allowing it to be itself. And so it was basically reducing it from it was reducing it from being who it was to being like just a thing. And that's what calling it the bug was doing. It's the same as when you use a slur to categorize any particular group of people because you don't want to see them as human. And that it's very, very direct correlations between what was happening with calling the Genosian the bug versus what happens in real life when people use slurs for others, because it removes emotional attachment and actually seeing them as a person turns them into almost an object with detachment, so it's a lot easier to attack them and treat them as nothing but an object. So, I'm not saying that it was a bad thing necessarily that they had it in the episode. I just thought it was a very interesting choice to show that on the side of the people that we are supposed to be seeing as the good guys, there's still this discrimination for certain species.
No, and that's, you know, you see that. Not, you know, when we talked about the droids at one point in time, we said,
yeah,
we don't serve their kind here. You know, there's definitely discrimination in the Star Wars universe. And I think it's meant to call out and kind of be a parallel to what we see here. And so we can recognize it and see it and kind of say, hey, you know, obviously it's not right. And that's when you look at like something like the Rebellion or the Resistance, it's got all species, races, colors, shapes, sizes, everything. But when you look at like the First Order or the Galactic Empire, similar to like the Nazi regime and the perfect Aryan race, you know, they want humans and that's it. You know, that's it. Alien species just don't exist in those, or very minor, and they have to prove themselves. You know, an exception being Thrawn, which was, again, not in the original trilogy, but in the books and obviously in Rebels right now. So I agree with you 100%. And I think Saw Gerrera in the seasons of Rebels was meant to kind of have us realize that right now at this point in time, he is with the Rebellion. You know, General Santo sent them, you know, the crew of the Ghost to go try to rescue him and find out what happened. But at the same time, you can see he's already on the fringes and kind of at odds with not only the crew of the Ghost, who we love dear because they're our, you know, our heroes of Rebels, but also even with the rest of the Rebellion, which we see in Rogue One. So I'm wondering how far off from where we saw Ghost of Geonosis to where Saw Gerrera goes out on his own to kind of create his own type of army.
Yeah.
No? Yeah, something?
Yeah.
All right. Overall, it's definitely worth catching, especially if not just the tie-in to Rogue One. And then you get to go see Rogue One one more time, which I think I'm going to go see tomorrow. So that'd be number four. That'd be the fourth time for me. How many times have you seen Rogue One, Danya?
Three.
All right. So yeah, three times here too. So I'll get to see it one more time, hopefully. But yeah, I enjoyed it overall. But it definitely, I don't know. It left. It was not one. You know, some episodes like you go, oh Ezra, like you get, you know, the facepalm type thing. This episode was definitely kind of, I don't know. It didn't leave me like happy or sad at the same time, but I'm glad like we got to see him. You know, it brings the lore of Star Wars further along, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It absolutely makes sense.
Yep. All right. Well, I think it's time for our spotlight topic. You agree?
Yes, I do.
All right. Well, our spotlight topic is none other than Galen Walton Erso. Walton, what a name. I don't know if I like it. Do you? Walton? Galen's a weird name, too. I don't know. I like it. Galen Erso. Walton, I don't know if it fits. GWE. I don't know. Anyway, moving on. Let's talk about Galen Erso, everybody. So, there was interesting things. Like, we learn a lot about Galen Erso in Catalyst. You know, we see very little in Rogue One, but he was the central character of the Catalyst novel. And if you haven't read Catalyst, you may want to skip our spotlight topic today. Go listen to it. Use our, you know, Audible free trial, you know, audibletrial.com/resistanceradio. Download it, listen to it. It's pretty good as an audiobook. It's also good to read, too. But, you know, we learn all about him in Catalyst, Anya.
And yes, we do.
I know, right? And I found it really interesting as I started reading Catalyst that Galen starts off his journey very similar to Luke Skywalker. I don't know if you put that together. Galen was born on a backwater planet named Grange to farmers, you know, not moisture farmers, but, you know, to farmers. So kind of like Luke, you know, being on Tatooine, kind of a backwater planet itself, or back sand planet, if you will, to Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. Yeah, these are the jokes, people. You got to listen. And then obviously he went on to do, like Luke, you know, kind of be very important to, you know, the galaxy. Like, he was very impactful to the galaxy. So someone being born on this kind of out of the way place to being something so, you know, impactful to the rest of the galaxy as a whole. And if you don't know what Galen was responsible for, you can almost blame him for the deaths of Alderaan, because he's the one that created that laser. Anyway.
Oh, so, it's a little bit more complicated than that, I think.
That's what we're going to explore. All right. So this is the intro here. So Galen started off being literally a special child, earning all sorts of different science and engineering scholarships, and entering into the Republic Futures program. And it's during that Republic Futures program where Galen befriends a young Orson Krennic, who, although is gifted, Krennic realizes very young that Galen is the true genius that we need. So this is before the Clone Wars. You know, he's just a scholar. He's somebody who's going to school. What do you think about Galen at this time and him becoming friends with Krennic in school?
I mean, I feel like we talked a lot about Krennic and his propensity for manipulation, especially emotional manipulation. So I feel like in terms of Galen and Krennic's friendship, Krennic was very good at being able to figure out what he needed to do in order to gain Galen's trust and make him dependent on him. So for Galen, Krennic was almost like his protector of sorts. And Krennic obviously orchestrated that because he saw what Galen was and what he had the potential to be in respect to Krennic's own career and sort of path in life. So I thought it was very, very, very interesting to see where Galen came from, and that mostly he's there for the knowledge. Galen is there for, like, the science, just the information and what it can do and how it can better things, because he's very much a pacifist.
So, you know what this really reminded me of? And it's kind of weird, like, the relationship between Krennic and Galen, at least at this time, obviously becomes a little bit more sinister, more manipulative later on, which we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. But at this time, and kind of seeing it all the way through to what Krennic kind of builds it into with Galen, I saw this as, for those of you who know me outside of just the podcast, I'm a big Apple fan. Heck, I've worked with Apple for 13 years. It kind of reminded me of the relationship between Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak at Apple. Woz was the genius that actually invented the computer and the Apple and everything. And Steve, although many consider him a genius, you know, Steve Jobs, a genius, and he was definitely a visionary, he realized the person who actually can create the revolutionary product kind of worked with him and kind of almost stole the thunder, which is kind of what happened between Galen and Krennic. You know, Krennic saw the true genius that is, you know, Galen, and used it to his own benefit, you know, in a way that benefited them both, but not maybe as much as like the Apple story and history and everything. But do you think that has any kind of similarities, or am I just reaching? Cause...
Yeah, no, I would say that to an extent it has some correlation between the two. I mean, yeah. I love Woz.
Yeah, who doesn't love the Woz, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, like, I just kind of saw this, like, Krennic realizing, you know, you saw it early on, like, the really weird part about, I will say, Catalyst, is it jumps around from person to person, but always focusing almost on Galen the entire time.
Yeah.
So, like even though you're having, like, you know, a perspective from Lyra to Krennic to, you know, Galen himself, what we're seeing, you know, the omnipresent view that we're seeing, it's always about Galen. We never see, like, Lyra really just on her own, really. It's all about, like, how this is affecting Galen and his relationship. So the whole book is all about the story of Galen Erso.
Yeah.
So it definitely is interesting to see, you know, that Krennic, from his own internal monologue, realized how important Galen could be in the future, and that's why he befriended him. But after the Futures program, they both go their separate ways. Krennic goes into working for the Republic, during the Clone Wars, and Galen is working on his own, in research on a planet called Vault. So just to read, I have a quote that I want to read here, just to kind of give you a perspective of Galen Erso. So from Galen, we're onto something big with this last batch of kyber crystals. I can feel it. There's no telling at this point what the limits are. Power enough to supply enriched and renewable energy for entire continents, certainly. Perhaps for entire worlds. I do ache to get back to a facility to continue the work. Research is the only thing I'm good at, and I'm determined to provide for you and our child. This is where Galen sees that his research, like, he is a researcher, he is a, you know, an academic, if you will, and he is obsessed with crystals, kyber crystals, synthetic kyber crystals, and he can see the immense power, but his intentions for this power that he pulls from these crystals is all for energy, for powering, you know, a clean energy for planets, for continents, never for weaponization. So while on the planet where they're, you know, testing these in his research facility on Vault, it's overthrown by the Separatist Alliance, and he was imprisoned for about a year with his wife while they were trying to escape the planet. And in the end, they were eventually released, being orchestrated by Krennic specifically. You know, even though when he was working for him, what was the company he was working for? I'm trying to remember. I don't have it written down here. Is it... He was on Vault. Do you remember, Danya?
No, not off the top of my head.
Let's see. Krennic was working for Republic Special Weapons, which is why he started doing the Death Star. Zerpen. It was Zerpen, wasn't it? I'm going to say it was Zerpen.
Yes. Yeah, Zerpen Industries.
All right, yeah. Zerpen Industries, exactly. So even though Galen's request, you know, for, you know, plea for help was received by Zerpen Industries at the request of Krennic, he wasn't released. Instead, Krennic orchestrated an entire elaborate plan to do a prisoner exchange to release Galen, so that way Galen would be in his, you know, in his debt. Like, that is that's psychotic.
Yes, yes, it is.
It is. It's absolutely psychotic. And the worst part about all this is that Galen was thankful that his dear friend from school is the one who saved him.
Yep, yeah, he is. And I feel for Galen very much, because this is behavior that is very indicative of, like, abusive relationships. The power balance is so out of control in respect to the power being in one person's hands entirely due to them holding all of the knowledge and all of the power and everything that they need in order to manipulate a situation exactly where they are. And the other one not having all of that information at their disposal and therefore usually emotionally manipulated into believing a situation is a certain way when it's not. So it's very much a classic abusive relationship. You know, it never is physically abusive, but mentally abusive, absolutely. And to a point where Galen doesn't even realize what's going on. But Krennic, like, it's incredible, like, the lengths that he goes to ensure that Galen is completely in his debt and cannot escape him.
You know, the worst is, even, like, after he's freed, Krennic sets Galen up with a job for Helical Hypercom. And not even, like, Galen, who's used to being his own boss because he is literally a genius with these crystals and power and everything. He sets him up with a job with this company where they're producing, you know, crystal arrays for communications, but he's not his own boss. He has a boss who he is smarter than, who he offers, like, suggestions like, hey, we can do this. It'll save us 40% in power for production. It'll make it cheaper. And his boss is like, no, you are underneath him, like, really kind of, like, not doing what he should be doing just to put Galen in his place. And Krennic does this because Galen doesn't want to do anything to support the war effort that is the Clone Wars still. And I get that, like, trying to stay away from it. But Krennic literally puts him in this position to kind of belittle Galen the entire time. Like, this is manipulative on a grand scale, not just him, but also affecting his wife, Lyra, and their daughter, Jin, while they're on this planet and he's just working. You know, Galen
doesn't hate it completely, but... Yeah, well, he's definitely not challenged mentally.
But yeah, he's kind of coasting along.
Yeah. So he gets to a point where he's almost desperate to be able to work on what he sees as his life's dream, which is creating clean energy for the galaxy. And Krennic just waits. He bides his time until Galen is at his lowest point, where he's beaten down so much and so desperate from the fact that he is essentially doing nothing. He's not using his mind in a way that is a credit to him or doing anything to help the galaxy. And Krennic then sets himself up again as this sort of white knight sweeping in to save him from this mundane life that he's coasting along on, that he's trying to provide a good life for Lyra and Jin. Oh,
White Knight is beyond, because not only is he saving him from his mundane life, you know, he's giving him his dream, but literally on the last day of the Clone Wars, the very last day of the Clone Wars, you know, Separatist forces attack the planet that Galen Erso and his family just happened to be working on. You know, it's a Republic planet. Separatist forces break through and kill a bunch of people and attack things. And as they were about to go ahead and almost kill Galen himself, the droids suddenly shut down. Galen believes this is because this is the destruction of the droid control ship. But at that time, that's the day the Clone Wars ended. That was the Order 66. And the Emperor claimed, you know, the new Galactic Empire. Like, this is the day. And guess what? We had, who was there to pick them up from Lorcai? Was none other than, you're right, his White Knight, Krennic, who then gets him into the dream job for the new galactic empire called Project Celestial Power. Like, that's, you're right. It's just so manipulative all the way through, you know, the Clone Wars and everything. And he knows, you know, like I said, Krennic knows exactly that Galen is the key to kind of raise him up even further. Just to give you an idea, like, this is Krennic talking to Mas Amida about Galen. Galen Erso is the Corps' most renowned polymath, a theoretician, a mathematician, engineer, and experimental physicist. At present, he is the preeminent authority on crystals and their use in supplying enhanced power. They were talking about the super laser on the Death Star. Krennic knows if they're going to get it to work, Galen has to be involved, even though he knows Galen will not willingly do it. But guess what? He has manipulated everything from freeing them on Vault to, I believe, the traumatization on Lorcai to getting him the job at Project Celestial Power. Do you agree with me, or am I just like...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, right, no, I absolutely
agree. Conspiracy theorist here, that this is what happened, and this is how the Death Star came about, and...
This isn't conspiracy theory at all. Krennic manipulated this whole situation to break Galen down to a point where when he eventually offered for him to work on Project Celestial Power, whether or not Galen believes in what the Empire stands for or not, it is so much the encapsulation of what Galen has wanted to do and worked for and worked towards his entire life, this project to create clean energy for the galaxy. Beating him down to the point that he's at, this trauma, everything, means that when Krennic approaches him with this project, he agrees because he doesn't see anything sinister in it. Because up until that point, every job previously that Krennic had approached Galen with was working for the Republic or working for a side that was invested in the Clone Wars. Well, now that that war is removed from the equation, and now that Galen has basically been set up emotionally to this point to trust implicitly in Krennic and what Krennic is doing, and he only has Galen's best interests at heart, he accepts work on the project without thinking about what it could be based on, like, the Empire and what the Empire is. Like, he just sees it at face value of, this is what I've wanted to do for my entire life, and Krennic has always kept me in mind, and he's doing what's best for me. He can't see beyond that, and it's definitely not Galen's fault. Like, he's been manipulated down to the letter to end up in this situation. And obviously Project Celestial Power, while everything involved in that is actually the research that he's doing, is actually with, like, the aim to generate clean energy. What's happening is all of that research is being siphoned off to other facilities within the Empire that are seeking to then weaponize that research. So, yeah, it's very intense, but I don't think you've gone conspiracy theory nuts. I think that is genuinely the thought process that we're meant to believe from the book.
Yeah. So with Celestial Power, as Galen gets more and more into successfully working with kyber crystals and research with Project Celestial Power, Lyra is separated from him by none other than Krennic. And this is when Lyra returns with suspicions of what Krennic is doing and suspicions of his intentions overall. And it's really interesting because at first you just wanted to scream at Galen. Like, you knew, like, we see this thing happening the whole time. And you just, like, while reading the book, you just want to kind of scream at Galen, like, wake up, listen to her. But eventually, you know, Lyra and Galen talk about these suspicions that she has, and he agrees that they need to flee. And they leave Coruscant, and this is where it's really interesting, because they leave Coruscant, and they use somebody named Saw Gerrera to flee the planet and get away. What do you think about that? Again, tying back to Saw Gerrera that we saw before.
Obviously, it makes a lot of sense, especially considering his beliefs and how he's set up and his little... Because obviously we know that the rebellion at this sort of... in its infancy at this point is made up of very small pockets of rebels that haven't quite started to coordinate with each other. And we know that Saul has been... like a rebel in his core for forever. Like, he resists everything. Like, he resists. So having him be the figure to get them away from the Empire, I thought was a very clever use of Saw Gerrera.
As a character, I will say this, when I saw that Saw Gerrera was the character that did this, going into Rogue One, going into what I saw in Clone Wars, up until the Rebels from this past week, I was super excited. I'm like, all right, Saw's one of the good guys. And he is on the rebellion side, which if you take good versus bad, he is. But talking about it now, knowing who Saw Gerrera has become, it's one of those things where it's kind of bittered me towards his character as a person. And I'm like, yeah, Saw helped him out. That's kind of cool. Like, blah. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. No.
Oh, I mean, I feel like it's not as simple as he's good or he's not.
Yeah, he's because, conflicted.
And I guess people are inherently flawed in what they do and what they're willing to do for freedom. You know, there are varying stages in which you will look at what you are willing to do to ensure your own freedom. So, and I guess the freedom of others as well. And Saw is on, like, the very extreme side of it. So.
Yeah, and you know, and I get it. Not everyone, you know, agrees with one side of it, but... So anyway, they flee the Empire, and this is where we kind of pick up in Rogue One as a film. So in Rogue One, at the very beginning, is that flashback. We have Galen being confronted and captured by Krennic. And for those of you who don't realize, the lady that gets shot early on in the film is Galen's wife and Jyn's mother, Lyra, who is fairly large part in the Catalyst book, but was on screen for all of, what, 30 seconds, you think, Danya?
If that,
you know, like all of 30 seconds, maybe, if that, which is, you know, for those who read Catalyst, it's actually really, you know, like, I was like, oh, there's they killed her. And it was kind of touching. It's like, oh my gosh. Like, I was really like taken aback because it was someone who I'd already known and cared about, but it was taken out so quickly. And obviously you're meant to see that, you know, Krennic is pretty ruthless from the get go. And obviously that's what we see. But yeah, so what happens is after being captured by Krennic, you know, Galen says this in his message to Saw Gerrera and if his daughter's alive, but he decides after basically believing his wife and daughter are gone, he gives in to what Krennic asks and starts actually using his knowledge and his research, not for power of clean energy for continents or planets, but for the Death Star super laser. But it is at this point where he makes the decision that he has to go along with it, in the hopes that he can build a weakness and that hopefully he can at one time, you know, let Saw, someone he trusts, the information to destroy the planet or the Death Star super laser. So, yeah. So, you know, it's one of those things you can tell at this point he has been beaten down completely because not only has he lost his wife, he believes he's lost his daughter, everything he's ever cared about, all his research has been perverted into something he doesn't want to leave as a legacy behind. And he's got one last ditch effort, otherwise he's dead himself. And he, you know, it's one of those things where I can see him being who he is, having wanted to stay out of war, not wanting to build weapons, kind of being like, I'm going to go along with it in the hopes that I can still make a difference, even though I have no choice, versus letting himself be killed. Like, would you agree that's his character?
Yeah, I would agree quite a lot, but I would also say that he obviously mentions in Rogue One that though Krennic hadn't realized it at the time, that the research was at a point where they could have finished the project without him. They just hadn't connected everything together in the way that they needed to in order to figure that out. So he knew that once they realized that he was then no longer going to be of use, like they would do it without him, and that version of the Death Star would have no weakness in it. It would be unbeatable. So he goes along with it because if he keeps Krennic's obsession focused on completing the Death Star and his... Because, let's... Long and short of it, Krennic is obsessed with Galen. Like, actually obsessed with what Galen stands for. And so if Galen keeps him focused on the fact that he's working towards this goal that Krennic has set and doesn't make him, like, look away, that he can build in that weakness because he's keeping him distracted. And so playing up to Krennic's obsession, almost Galen turns Krennic's manipulations on its head because he uses it against him. And it's incredibly clever as a character point that Galen has reached a point where he's like, I can use this. I can take back the power and try and do something good in what is essentially a hopeless situation. Because with or without him, the Death Star was getting created. It may have taken them a little bit longer to figure it out, but it was going to happen, regardless of his involvement. And so he does the one thing that he can do. He uses Krennic's obsession against him, and basically leads to installing something in the Death Star that means that it can be destroyed, it can be beaten, it can be taken down. He gives hope back to the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that's, and like I said, that him being able to be the architect of the hope that we see that the rebellion has really was, at least for me, made Rogue One that good of a film, because it not only answered a few common questions people had, but it shows that the flaw there was by design. It was something that someone created on purpose, even mm-hmm. though they were creating something absolutely horrible. So Galen, even though you were beaten down, you really were an unsung hero that most people don't realize. And actually, I don't think anyone realized, because, you know, really the only person that saw his message of what he did was Jyn and Saw, and Saw is dead. Jyn wasn't believed when she told other people, other than a handful of people, and she's dead. So Galen will remember you.
Yeah. Yep. And that's the thing as well, is that considering the sacrifice as well, that that the squadron, the Rogue One squadron basically made in order to get those plans of what Galen had done, the focus was, and I would say quite rightly, like, the sacrifice that they made in order to get those plans out was incredible, because mm-hmm. they literally gave their lives in order to save more people. You know, it's very much, and I'm gonna blaspheme here. I'm gonna blaspheme. Don't kill me, guys. I'm going to say that it very much reminds me of Star Trek's ideology the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one.
okay. I'll agree with you on that.
Yeah, you get what I mean? So a lot of the focus, especially in the immediate aftermath, was always going to be on them and the sacrifice that they made. You know, at that point, they'd already set up Galen as this figurehead of the Empire, that actually he was this officer within the Empire that was creating this super weapon. And the truth of that doesn't seem to have filtered down, because in the immediate aftermath of getting the plans, there's just so much to take in, because it's so frantic. You know, it's still out there. Then Alderaan gets destroyed, and there's just so much that happens in the immediate aftermath that I feel like Galen's sacrifice, which is that he gave his life to the Empire in order to give the rebellion a way to destroy the Death Star, won't be remembered because it was a quiet resistance.
Yeah. It was, and I think, I don't know, overall, Galen was a very important character, and I'm glad we got a chance to kind of talk to him, because he was so important to that quiet resistance and the kind of rebellion that he built with, by being able to put that Death Star.
Yeah. Out
the hole there. So, that was our discussion about Galen Erso. Anything I missed or we missed, Anya? I know I filled out quite a few notes on Galen, at least what we know from Catalyst. We might learn more at another time.
No, I think we covered quite a lot of it.
I think we did too.
Yeah.
If you have any thoughts on Galen Erso or Project Celestial Power, let us know in your tweets at Resistance Radio, at our radio podcast. As always, thank you all for listening to another episode of Resistance Radio. Feel free to reach out to us at Twitter at our radio podcast, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Resistance Radio Podcast. As always, I'm Mikey B.
And I'm Danya.
And may the Force be with you.
And also with you.
I rebelled.